The Egyptian Mysteries, Isis, by Arthur Versluys. Extracted from The Egyptian Mysteries, published by Penguin, copyright by the author, 1988. Drawing upon Vedic, Buddhist, Greek, Roman, and Hermetic texts, the author examines the place of Isis in the ancient Egyptian mystery tradition. In many respects, the origins of Western tradition, not as an isolated phenomenon, but in the light of the great traditions still in existence. By setting the mystery tradition in the context of the primordial tradition, its relation to our present era begins to emerge. To understand the modern world and our place in the cosmos, it is necessary to understand the mysteries. Arthur Versluys, author of numerous books and articles, serves as chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Michigan State University. He is the founding president of the American Association for the Study of Esotericism and a leader in the scholarship of esotericism in North America.
Perhaps no god or goddess has ever enjoyed the worship and celebration of so many throughout the ancient world, from the earliest times up to and through the time of Christianity, as did Isis. Indeed, even after Isis herself had vanished under that name, she of the many names continued under the guise of the Virgin Mary, who in turn assumed many of the functions that Isis had served in earlier epochs. Both, like Kanzion Bodhisattva in Mahayana Buddhism, hear the cries of the world. Both are the compassionate deliverers of the world's suffering. But who is Isis, the Regina Coeli, Queen of Heaven? For an answer, we turn first to the myth of Isis and Ra, found in the Turin Papyrus, in which Isis is seen as blackmailing the poisoned sun god Ra into revealing his most secret sacred names of power, in return for an antidote. For in this tale, we can see the principal essence of Isis. She is mediatrix between the celestial and the terrestrial. In the text in question, Isis is defined as she who loved the gods, she who was wearied of men, she who loved best the realm of the spirits. In other words, Isis, though necessarily partaking of the highest realms, those of the gods and of Ra, was nonetheless most closely affiliated with the immediate subtle realm, the world of spirits, Bhuva, the atmosphere, the vast sea in which the temporal world was precipitated like a tiny island. Isis is the queen of the subtle realm, and therefore in her own way mistress of the earth, like Ra, and of like rank and power in heaven, for she rules the essences of herbs and animals and all sentient things. According to the myth under consideration, Isis hit a dart in Ra's path, and when he encountered it, he fell mortally poisoned, and was revitalized only by divulging to Isis, the great sorceress, his true names. Within this tale, we begin to glimpse the nature of Isis, elucidated by the Kabbalistic teaching that each of the Sephiroth, when emanated, spilled over into disequilibrium, and were later returned to divine order, and that each of the Sephiroth corresponded to aspects of the divine names. For both the Kabbalah and the tales of Isis refer to the emanation of temporality from the real, to the essential superstructure of creation, mediate between above and below. That Isis, then, should have a mediate place in the Egyptian theogony is only proper, for she, like Egypt herself at that time, lay mediate between the primordial past and the secular materialistic future, between the sacred and the profane. Although in the myth under consideration, Ra is depicted as being senile and decrepit, obviously, since Ra cannot in his nature change, it must be something else which is being suggested. In fact, it is not Ra who becomes senile, but rather man who becomes blind to Ra. In this tale, in other words, we see not the senescence of Ra, but the senescence of Egypt herself, and her blindness to Ra, a blindness remedied by Isis, who acts as intermediary or bridge between man and the sun, to which he is ever more blind. Isis, in sum, not fundamentally different from the sun, is rather a manifestation of the divine compassion accessible to man in an age of waning faith and wisdom. Hence, Isis said, I have revealed to mankind mystic initiations. I have taught reverence for the gods. I have established the temples. Now, needless to say, these are ultimately the actions of the divine sun, inherent within creation and within humanity, from whom Isis cannot be separate. However, within a given historical period, certain incarnations or manifestations of the divine are of far more aid than others. They speak to a given age and need, and so it was, and perhaps is for Isis. As is said in the litany, Praises of Ra, Thou art indeed Isis. When Isis or any bestows blessing upon man, it is Ra who bestows them. From this we can begin to see the relation of Isis to Nephthys, her sister, and consort of Typhon, the latter being a reflection and aspect of Isis, just as Isis is an aspect of Ra. According to Plutarch, Isis is that which is manifest. Nephthys is, or rules, that which is unmanifest. Nephthys, then, is that of the subtle realm, which is unmanifest, which is outside the pale of the temporal realm, whereas Isis is she of the green wings and the crescent moon. And while including Nephthys as one aspect of her, nevertheless pertains more the world below the moon, the world of generation and of living beings. Nephthys, on the other hand, is the shade of Isis. She manifests the residues or traces of the living world, representing decay, dissolution. The rising of the Nile. Isis's sign was Sothis, the dog star, which signified her power, for that star was associated with the rising of the Nile and the coming of life anew each year. This association was reinforced by her companion, Hermatibus, the divine messenger, who lives between the divine and the earthly realms, whose dog head is half black and half gold, and whose barking separates stranger from friend. The name Sothis derives from a trinity of gods, Seth or Typhon, the principal power of darkness, ignorance, anger, and destruction, Osiris, and his consort Isis herself. In this one star is, then, a complex glyph of Osiris being overcome by Seth, found by Hermatibus, rescued and restored by Isis, all condensed into its cyclical pattern, marking the heat of summer and the cold depths of winter, the rising and the falling of the Nile, all life. An even clearer indication of Isis' nature can be glimpsed from two tales related by Pausanias of men who had dared to profane the temples. In both tales, a profane man who had no right to enter burst into the temple out of curiosity, one on his own account, the other on behalf of a Roman governor. Both entered during festival time. Both found the shrine filled with specters. The first returned to Tithyrea, where he died. The other returned to the Roman governor, told his tale, and then immediately expired as well. Pausanias thereby concludes that it is ill for mankind to see the gods in bodily shape, echoing Homer. While the tales do not divulge anything of the mysteries themselves, they do corroborate our observation that Isis's domain was essentially the subtle realm, the realm of specters, and that sacred knowledge is self-protecting. The only remaining account in toto of that which could be lawfully revealed of the mysteries, and the mysteries of Isis in particular, is that of Apuleius in his novel, The Golden Ass. Although clearly we cannot reproduce that tale in its entirety here, despite its worthiness, we can at least distill from it the general characteristics of initiation, as well as of Isis herself. For from this account we can see quite clearly that even at that late date, even in the 2nd century AD Rome of Apuleius. The power of Isis was unabated, immense, able to inspire her worshippers with visions of her splendor, with the inexpressible plenitude and gratitude of a reception into the divine. Then from the ocean she rises. Apuleius' account of the mysteries is to be found in Book 11, beginning when, having been exhausted by his miseries, driven to the very edge of the sea by his troubles and enchantments, at Land's End, the hero Lucius immerses himself 7 times in the ocean, and with tear-stained face turns to the orb of the full moon as it emerged from the waves of the sea. In dire straits, bereft of all hope, he addresses Isis, she of the moon, queen of heaven. Whether you be Ceres, motherly nurse of all growth, or celestial Venus, who in the first moment of creation mingled the sexes, in the generation of mutual desires, or the sister of Phoebus or Persephone, whose triple face has the power to ward off the assaults of ghosts and to close the cracks in the earth, dispensing your radiance where the sun has abandoned us. Then from the ocean she rises, such beauty as words fail to approach. Upon her head is a chaplet of flowers, in the midst of which is a circlet, a softly glowing moon supported by 2 vipers that rise from the earth near blades of corn. Her garments are many-hued, yellow, white, red, while around them falls a softly shining black cape, passing over her left shoulder, a cape spangled with stars, a crescent moon breathing forth from the center. In her right hand is a triple cord of the sistrum. In her left hand, a golden boat, above which rises the head of an asp from its sacred coils. To poor Lucius, whose true nature by virtue of his name is light, still entrapped in the body of an ass, she speaks. Behold, Lucius, moved by your prayer, I come to you. I, the natural mother of all life, mistress of the elements, first child of time, supreme divinity, queen of those in hell, first of those in heaven, the manifestation of all the gods and goddesses. I, who govern by my nod the crest of light in the sky, the purifying wafts of the ocean, and the lamentable silence of hell. I, whose single godhead is venerated over all the earth, under manifold forms, varying rites, and changing names. She admonishes Lucius to only remember her, for by keeping the remembrance fast in his heart's deep core, he should, if he remains faithful after death, live on, praising her in the Elysian fields. For if you are found to merit my love, by your dedicated obedience, religious devotion, and constant chastity, you will discover that it is within my power to prolong your life beyond the limits set to it by fate. Solace to the troubled human soul. It is quite certain that we have here not simply a literary account of the mysteries, not as with Firmicus Maternus a bitter diatribe by a Christian against the pagans, nor the distant and personal account of Plutarch, but the words of an eyewitness, sympathetic of Isis as she really was, seen through the eyes of her worshippers. And though her worshippers were drawn from every class, we have here an account by one of the literati, a scholar, who had found serenity not in the bitter cross of anxiety, as the Roman phrase had it, but in the folds of the great goddess's robe. Here, unmistakably, we have a true religious experience, one which speaks to, gives solace to, the troubled soul of man, for whom neither scholarship nor earthly delights offer any lasting comfort. It is for this reason that Apuleius' account is so moving. The account of his initiation builds to a kind of universal climax. The populace throngs into the city as the sun rises. All are jubilant, buoyant as Lucius himself, who knows that his deliverance is imminent. The colorful pageant goes on, women dressed in the white vestures of spring, scattering balm and flowers, while others bear mirrors upon their backs, walking before the goddess so that all approach her image. Musicians play upon their pipes, poets recite. The shaven initiates walk behind in a great band, dressed in purest white, shaking sistras of brass, silver, and gold, with the priest in the rear, carrying the great lamp and the altars. Behind all follow the gods themselves, the messengers of heaven and hell, Anubis, face half black and half gold, bearing his rod in his left hand, followed by a cow, emblem of the mother of all, and last of all, one bearing the sacred symbol of the supreme deity, inexpressible, veiled in the deep silence of true religion. A wealth of symbols. Throughout Apuleius' account, we find a wealth of descriptions of the mysteries and of sacred symbology. The sistrum with its three cords for the three worlds. The sacred ureus, the asp which symbolized this coiled serpent of Shakti, entwined around us Shiva, or of Isis coiled around Osiris. Isis arising from the great ocean. The golden bark of Ra, the sun in which the dead find life eternal, a kind of immortality, the gooseneck prow of the sacred bark, signifying the unerring homeward path which Isis and Ra represented. Indeed, the list is long, the symbolism intricate. But what of the initiation itself? Of that, Lucius can say little, not because he would not, but because he cannot. Not least because the power of the goddess is to bestow death, as well as life, punishment as well as weal. And yet from this tale, the essence of the event, the turning can be inferred. We can see there the immense gratitude and serenity, the joy and universal harmony which it bestows, not only upon him alone, but upon all in the populace, to each according to his need. As Apuleius says, at midnight the sun shone in all its full splendor. I could tell you more, but you would not understand. The sun shines at midnight. In this we see the essence of the black rite of the ancient Egyptians, of the entry into death itself, which lies at the heart of the mysteries. For initiation is a kind of voluntary death, with but the slightest chance of redemption. Initiation bestows a redemption in the sun, the divine sun which appears in the very depths of human despair, when egotism is transcended, when the world of forms, subtle and dense, drops away. Then at midnight comes that of which nothing more can be said, divine plenitude overwhelming. Isis, then, is the principal generative force, associated with the healing herbs and the powers of medicine, with the growth of wheat and corn, the domestication of which marked the inception of Egypt herself, and delineated the entrance into its present historical epoch, being mediatrix, meeting point, as it were, of the gods and the temporal world. Hers is the self-motive power of generation, of which agriculture is the outward manifestation, and of which the green wings and crescent moon are symbol. The root of her name is closely affiliated with the Egyptian root pra, which implies house or home, suggesting that she is mistress within the houses of the gods. As Cassiopeia, she reclines head downwards upon the night horizon. One of her names, too, was Isis Pelagia, she of the waves. Hence, as Venus, she was envisioned as riding above the ocean of temporality. Yet she was also Demeter, or Earth Mother, which in Greek became Demeter. One of the most suggestive characteristics of Isis, however, is her relation to the coiled serpents or asp with which she is always associated. For the serpent is almost universally a symbol of the vital force, the coiled essence of life itself, rising up the spine to the crown of the head. This attribution of the life force to the serpentine form is particularly true within tantric tradition, in which Kundalini, the serpent of life, who slumbers at the base of the spine, in the realm of generation, is awakened as it rises up the susumna, the sacred channel, axis of the body, through the aperture of Brahma, conferring liberation upon the adept. Although we cannot, of course, say that Isis is Shakti, or that Osiris is Shiva, the central pole around which the coiled serpent Shakti is slumbering, yet nonetheless the two pairs are incontrovertibly interrelated. It is not, after all, insignificant that the constellation Cassiopeia, she of the throne, should circle around the pole with the passage of the year, just as Isis, with whom she is associated, hovered over the slain Osiris to reinvigorate him after his death and dismemberment. Shiva and Shakti. What then is the relationship between Shiva and Shakti? Essentially, it is that between power, Shakti, and power holder, Shiva, between activity and the quiescent center. Shiva is the power holder, Shaktiman, and Shakti is the power, the great mother of the universe. Shiva is pure consciousness, Shakti is mind, life, matter. Neither can exist without the other. Like Osiris and Isis, they were joined together in the womb as one. They are a divine reality from which, when we overlay name and form, nama and rupa, mind and matter, the cosmos arises. Hence Isis is she of many names, and so according to the Kubrika Tantra, it is not Brahma, Vishnu, and Rudra who create, but their Shaktis. Activity is the nature of Prakriti, for which reason the female is depicted above the male in tantric representations, just as Isis, in Egyptian iconography, hovered above the prone Osiris. To continue the tantric imagery, in the earth center called the Muladhara Chakra, Kundalini Shakti manifests as a serpent coiled around a self-produced phallus, Svayambalinga. Indeed, the word Kundalini means coiled, or in potentia, and she is said to produce the phenomenal world by the veiling Maya, of pure consciousness of herself, as consciousness, spiraling forth spontaneously, thereby creating the eggs of Brahma, Brahmanda, by turning back upon herself once, forming a coil or loop. In Greek symbolism, which derived from the Egyptian, this form was termed the Orphic egg. When she turns back upon herself for a third time, the pyramid shape is said to be formed. Sarangataka. Like Isis, she is a receptacle of that continuous stream of ambrosia, which flows from eternal bliss, from Brahman through Shiva. She, the world bewilderer, is bright as millions of moons, and by her in this world egg, Brahmanda illumined. Like Isis, her symbol is the white lotus which floats upon and rises out of the mire of dense matter, and yet is pure and unsullied. In brief, we can see from this discussion that there is indeed a direct correspondence between the metaphysics of Tantrism and the symbology of ancient Egypt, and that the former can shed a great deal of light upon the latter, of which is left, as prophesied, only carvings in stone, the merest outward signs. But no doubt the two traditions descended from a common source in the indefinitely ancient past, perhaps through the Chaldees, certainly the Near East. Regardless of their apparent differences, the two traditions are virtually identical in symbology, correspondences which, though arising out of universal truth, nevertheless point to a temporal unity as well. Essentially, the Egyptian mysteries, like the yoga of Tantrism, consisted in the return or retracing of the creation of the cosmos inwardly, so that just as in the beginning, which always is, being supratemporal, there was only bliss, pure consciousness, so too the mortal who sheds the immortal coil, or perhaps more accurately, releases it, recapitulates inwardly and inversely the creation, attaining through her the creative power, union with the primordial. It is interesting while considering this parallelism between the tantric tradition and the ancient Egyptian to note that a predominant symbol of Isis was the cow, Nut, not only because she is a manifestation of the abundance of the earth, and because she is emblematic of the shift from the primordial golden age to the traditional agriculture of ancient Egypt, based upon wheat, barley, and cattle, being therefore symbols of Isis and of traditional civilization, both of which lie mediate between the above and the below, but also because the two horns of the cow suggest the horns of the waxing moon, the duality of the world of generation as well. And the symbol of the sacred cow reappears in the Upanishads, where speech is likened to a celestial cow, of which the first two udders are of the gods, Svaha, Vasat. The third is that of man, Hanta, and the fourth is that of the father, Pitri, and termed Svada. The vital breath is her bull, mind is her calf, and so once again we see the perennial trinity, Osiris, the bull, Isis, the cow, and Horus, the calf. Various traditions can illuminate one another. Now we must, throughout consideration of these matters, keep in mind that although we speak in dualistic terms of Shiva and Shakti, of Osiris and Isis, these are not separate entities, but rather aspects or emanations of one another, and of the Supreme Lord Ishvara, himself an emanation of the Divine Sun. Indeed, this is perhaps the central error of the modern, in turning to ancient metaphysics, the false attribution of literalism and dualism to the traditional, like the Chinese Taoist teaching of yin and yang, for which mere dualism would be anathema, unthinkable, such teaching belonging as it does to the world of the primordial unity. As a result, the various traditions can illumine one another, insofar as each is a reflection of the same principal unity, and this illumination is especially necessary today due to modern fragmentation and incomprehension. In any event, having examined Isis's significance in terms of cosmology and in terms of the initiation of Lucius, it is apparent that however magnificent the metaphysical implications of her as creator, it is evident that her power and historical longevity in the 4th century AD, when Christianity was finally able to destroy the remnants of the religions of antiquity, hers was still the predominant sect, was due to her answering a primordial need within man, an answer to individual longing. She, the Magna Mater, the Holy One, was the healer of man, she who resurrects, she who comes to the aid of the suffering, and who with them suffered, sitting lowly and tearful by the well of Byblos. She, humanity's never absent sanctum, from whom even the gates of hell were open to those who were truly penitent. And it was here that her true and unassailable religious power lay, not in her cosmological meaning, but in the revelation of her divine mercy, her love, in her role as healer and comforter. In fact, it was common practice in ancient Egypt to sleep in her temples, and by virtue of the influences therein, to be healed, or to obtain a vision of her, aspects of the same mercy. Essential to her working, though, was the element of surprise, of divine lightning. Like Kanzion Bodhisattva, her healings appeared when least expected, and when the future looked most dim. For then the opening was there, so that the divine might burst forth, illuminating and resurrecting life, even as through the lamenting Isis, Osiris could be resurrected from fragmentation and death. And it is here in individual revelation, in the dynamism of her infinite power, in the bestowing of peace and harmony upon those in distress, that Isis's power still resides, still manifests, if only one has unswerving faith, dedication, and devotion. The great mother of all 10,000 things cannot vanish. It is only we who become blind to her wisdom and solace. Yet when we turn back, she is still there, as she was for Lucius, beckoning, alluring, and welcoming.